This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It's one thing to invent the technology, and then you need to get over what energy experts call the valley of death, where the technology is viable, but there's no way to get it from invention stage to commercial stage. And that's one role that Mr. Gates is trying to fill here.
If you had $1 million, what would you do with it? Okay, now what if it were $100 billion? Today on Sea Change Radio, we're talking with Amy Harder, environment and climate reporter for Axios, about where some titans of industry are investing their money and the environmental impact it might have. You might be surprised to learn, for example, that Bill Gates has been pouring some of his considerable wealth into the nuclear energy sector. Harder recently interviewed Gates about his estimated $500 million investment into TerraPower. She tells us about that, as well as the big bets that companies like ExxonMobil are making on ethane, a petrochemical byproduct that's used to produce plastic. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Amy Harder. She is an energy and climate change reporter for Axios. Amy, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me on.
So you just interviewed a very wealthy man who most people know, Mr. Bill Gates, about his investments in the nuclear energy sector. First, why don't you tell us a little bit about TerraPower?
Yeah, well, this is my second time interviewing Mr. Gates, actually, in just the last year or so. He has really been ramping up his focus and money, which, of course, he has a lot. His net worth is about $100 billion, with a B. Over the last couple of years, he's been ramping up his focus in this area, and that's one reason why I've been talking with him more. TerraPower is actually one of his oldest investments in this space. It's a nuclear power technology firm based out of Seattle, Washington, which, of course, is where he's from. And also, I'm a native Washingtonian as well, so we have that to share as well. And he's been working on this technology since 2006, and he's been optimistic for most of the, more than the last decade. But when we spoke just a couple of weeks ago, he struck a rare pessimistic tone. And that's what led me to, in my latest Harder Line column, to focus on that.
Yes, you say that he's invested nearly $500 million into TerraPower. Most people haven't heard of TerraPower. What is the promise of this technology?
Yeah, well, I should note that the $500 million figure is actually not an official estimate from the company or from Mr. Gates himself. He hasn't disclosed how much he has invested in TerraPower, so it could be more, probably not less. So TerraPower is one of several what's known as the fourth generation or the next generation of advanced nuclear power. The current technology is very big, it's very expensive, and many plants around the world, including the United States and France and Germany, nuclear power plants are actually shutting down due to a host of different reasons. So the future of this industry really is riding on technology like TerraPower. And what makes them different is, number one, the reactors, the nuclear reactors are much smaller than today's technology. But there's also other key advantages, such as with TerraPower, and I don't want to get too wonky, but the fuel that they use, the type of uranium they use, is actually currently considered a waste. So therefore, they're using a lot less of this very radioactive type of fuel, which solves, or at least lessens some of the concerns people have about what to do with the radioactive waste. But experts I talk to also say that there's a lot of concerns and challenges with this technology, which has been one of the reasons why TerraPower has been, working in this same space for more than a decade and doesn't have a demonstration reactor to show for it yet. And just one more point on this. The big point that I was focusing on in my column was Mr. Gates's reaction to a Trump administration move late last year to make it impossible for TerraPower to build its planned reactor in China. So TerraPower got wrapped up in President Trump's broader criticism of China and its trade policies. So that's the very specific issue that TerraPower is dealing with now. And they're going back to the drawing board, hoping to build a demonstration reactor here in the United States.
And it uses some sort of radioactive waste, but it still produces waste, right? It's just less waste. Is that the idea?
Correct. Far less waste than what we see in today's reactors.
And have any TerraPower reactors gone online? Are they producing energy for any consumers?
No. So that's the big holdup, is that they wanted to build a demonstration reactor, which is basically a test to test the technology. Last year, I actually went to TerraPower's lab, which is in Bellevue, Washington, right near Seattle. And they have, you know, it's about 10,000 square foot of space to research. And they've built what is basically a mock reactor. And then so they're putting different pieces of the puzzle in the same room. But they wanted to work with China, not just in China, but with the Chinese government, which is really what made it, you know, the target of the Trump administration policy. They wanted to build it there because, number one, there's a lot of electricity demand in China, which is something we don't have here in the United States. And also the Chinese government has a long-term energy strategy, which is also something the United States doesn't have. But to date, the technology only exists in a lab. And I reported as part of my latest column that although Mr. Gates was pretty down on the prospects for this next generation of nuclear power, he is TerraPower is opening a 50,000 square foot new lab just north of Seattle. So they're definitely, you know, continuing to put focus and money here, and we'll see, you know, if they come up with something that works. You know, I certainly wouldn't bet against Bill Gates, given his history and his expertise. But at the same time, you know, there's a lot of competing forces that are making this really challenging for him.
Sure. And so the U.S.-China collaboration element of it, would that be that TerraPower is hoping to sell their finished product to China, or would there be parts in this process in manufacturing that would come from China? Where is the holdup in terms of tariffs and Trump administration rhetoric?
Yeah, well, all of the whole entire deal is totally, you know, it's gone in terms of it being an option. It's off the table entirely because of what the Trump administration did. Last October, the administration, the Energy Department, cracked down on what kind of technological agreements U.S. companies can have with, Chinese-owned entities, like the one that TerraPower had inked a deal with. And so although TerraPower officials had been clear that there wasn't going to be any sort of exchange of technological ability from the U.S. to China, it nonetheless just made it impossible for them to continue.
So in terms of the Trump administration's rule from October that you're referencing, is that China-specific or not?
That is China-specific. So Mr. Gates was pretty clear to me, and I quote him in the column, saying that their strategy right now is to pursue a demonstration reactor in the United States. And so that means two things. That means Mr. Gates is focusing a lot on encouraging Congress to pass new legislation that would make it easier to build a demonstration reactor. It also means he wants the Energy Department to provide more funding for such a reactor. Experts I talked to, both who work for Mr. Gates and also outside experts, say that a reactor of this kind could cost anywhere between $3 to $6 billion, which is far more than what the Energy Department currently budgets for the Nuclear Energy Office at the department.
But isn't that still a lot less than the traditional nuclear reactors or not?
It is, but so is the amount of electricity you're getting. So it's a little bit apples to oranges. But right now, it's not really fair to compare existing technology to future potential nuclear power technology, the only nuclear power plant under construction today is this sort of old kind I've talked about that are very massive. And that's being built in Georgia by Southern Company. And it is not a model anybody would want to follow. It's over budget and delayed. And it's, I think when all is said and done, it's going to cost about $30 billion, which is not anything anybody would want to repeat. And so a lot of companies are actually swallowing those costs. So hopefully, you know, consumers won't have to shoulder those costs in Georgia and other places. But so that's one reason why companies are looking to make smaller reactors, because it's just too high upfront costs for these really big ones.
And what's your sense of the pulse politically for nuclear energy? Are the headlines from Fukushima and the fallout from that disaster still fresh in the minds of lawmakers? Or do you think they would be more stymied by this inefficient rollout in Georgia?
Yeah, well, there's several factors that kind of push against each other in terms of the politics of this. I do think as climate change becomes a greater and greater concern among the public and among politicians, you do see bipartisan support, growing bipartisan support for nuclear power. To what extent that translates into actual policy that makes a difference, I think, is an open question. And to date, we haven't really seen this, early and sort of budding bipartisanship that supports nuclear power really make a difference on the policy front. And, you know, there's also a lot of other dynamics. For the moment, a lot of utilities, you know, are focusing on natural gas and wind and solar, all of which is much cheaper than many of these advanced nuclear reactors, which are still, you know, at least five, you know, the soonest any advanced reactor could come online is 2026. So we're still talking far into the future. And by then, you know, maybe wind and solar and battery backup will be able to do it all in the electricity space. And so there's a lot of different factors here that I think are squeezing out this area of technology, even though there's a lot of focus and interest in it by people like Bill Gates.
And you quote Mr. Gates in your article saying, quote, "If at the end of the day we don't find a country that wants to build an advanced nuclear power plant, then TerraPower will fail. I'm going to keep funding it for a period of years, and working with the U.S. is our strategy right now." So what got him into TerraPower? It's not an obvious fit for somebody who's in the software business. But neither is the Gates Foundation and, what is it, Impossible Foods and some of these other far-reaching efforts. I guess when you have $100 billion, you can kind of dream big. Why do you think he's decided to leap with both feet into this project?
Yeah, well, ever since he sort of left the leadership position of Microsoft, he's really gotten into, you know, a lot of other interests that, you know, are a passion for him. And one of those is climate change, and in particular, energy innovation. So he has a private office, Gates Ventures, that leads a lot of this work. So he privately is an investor in a lot of companies trying to crack the toughest nuts of climate change. And then he also leads a group of billionaire investors investing in dozens of other companies. So for the last several years, he's been ramping up in this space. And I think, you know, he is investing in this space broadly speaking because I think he sees the need for innovation and the need for money to help really complicated but important technologies get over the hump of innovation. It's one thing to invent the technology, and then you need to get over what, you know, energy experts call the valley of death, where the technology is viable, but there's no way to get it from invention stage to commercial stage. And that's, I think, one role that Mr. Gates is trying to fill here. I would say on TerraPower in particular, you know, he co-founded it back in 2006. A lot has changed in the energy space in the last 13 years. You know, wind and solar costs have plummeted. The natural gas shale revolution in America has occurred. All of that has turned upside down the electricity question. And of course, nuclear power is used for electricity. And so a lot has changed in that time, and I think has made it more difficult for companies like TerraPower to happen. And so, as I quoted him in my article, you know, he may not fund it. He's not going to fund it indefinitely. And so there's 150 people that work at TerraPower, give or take. And, you know, I think it's a challenging time for them.
How does it feel to be one of the beautiful people? How often have you been there?
Often enough to know.
What did you see when you were there?
Nothing but doesn't show.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Amy Harder. She's an environment and climate change reporter from Axios. Changing the subject a little slightly. So you, as a reporter, you have to chase down some of the more wealthy, powerful people in the energy space, politicians, CEOs, but not many people as wealthy as Bill Gates on the planet. You mentioned how you're both from Washington, but I'm sure it required a few hurdles to leap over to talk to him directly. Maybe you can kind of give us a peek behind the curtain of what it was like to arrange that logistically. Was it difficult or is he fairly accessible?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it actually goes back to last fall. You know, Axios has a show on HBO. So quick shameless plug for that. It's called Axios on HBO. Mm-hmm. Which I encourage all your listeners to watch. And so back then, you know, we were looking for big name experts and leaders to interview on any host of topics. And I've been in touch with Gates's office energy advisors for many years. And, you know, I was talking with them, and they back then were saying that Mr. Gates was planning to be more vocal about just how complicated and difficult combating climate change is, that it's not just wind and solar, that electricity is only 25% of the problem, and there's all these other things you need to do, like, you know, make, you know, meat from sources other than beef, and, you know, make fertilizers from different sources, and make cement from different ways. And so back then in October, we actually approached Mr. Gates about an interview, and we ended up interviewing him in October for the HBO show, just from a very big picture perspective. So that sort of solidified a relationship I had already going. And then fast forward to late June, and his office just reached out and offered us the interview.
So Amy, you wrote a piece last month about ethane, which is a chemical I had never heard of, and it's the building block of plastic. Speaking of deep pockets like Bill Gates, ExxonMobil and Saudi-based SABIC, is it SABIC? I don't know how you pronounce that, but these very large companies are investing heavily into the ethane production world. Why don't you explain what ethane is and maybe expand on what these investments mean for the plastic industry?
I stumbled upon this by doing a story about plastics, as you said, and how many people I don't actually think know that all of the plastics we use in our daily lives come from oil and gas feedstock. So the raw materials of plastics all come from oil and natural gas. And ethane is one of those feedstocks. And this is a story about so many things. It's a story about people's growing concerns about plastic waste literally everywhere on the planet. It's a story about oil and gas companies trying to find a new area of growth, right as concern about climate change is growing and lessening the oil demand in their most reliable sector to date, which has been transportation. So you have these two things that are colliding with each other. You have the growing public concern about plastic waste, and you have the companies like Exxon, like Shell, investing in these billion-dollar petrochemical plants to offset the expected decline because of climate policies. And these two things are running head first into each other. And at the heart of that is this, you know, really wonky feedstock, which is a word too wonky for my editor. He made me define it. That is basically a byproduct of natural gas. And under the oil and natural gas boom that we've seen in the United States over the last decade plus, ethane has also increased significantly. And so this is an important feedstock. It's the most important feedstock when it comes to plastic around the world. And that's why I chose to focus on it for my coverage.
We've used feedstock a lot on this show when we've been exploring the biofuel industry. But feedstocks were part of the verbiage that we would always be engaged with when we were trying to learn more about these different biofuel processes. And they all use different feedstocks, whether it be algae or sugarcane, et cetera. So what separates ethane from other byproducts? Is there a better way to be making plastic? There's a lot of innovation in the plastic production area, and it seems like this is maybe kind of the old way of doing it, or is there some new twist to it?
Well, there's different types of petrochemical feedstocks, but those are all still in the oil and natural gas realm. So I actually don't know offhand all the different names of the different feedstocks.
Sure, sure.
Ethylene, ethane, you know, you can go down the wonky name list to get the various names of the petrochemical feedstocks. In terms of attempts to make plastics from non-petrochemical, non-oil and gas resources, there is a lot of work being done in this space. In fact, we featured a Lego's executive on our HBO show talking about this very thing. But Lego's has been trying to do this for years, trying to make their plastics, which of course we all well familiar with the Legos we played with as children, you know, they haven't had much luck at all making their plastics from things other than oil and gas. And so there's sort of two different schools of thought about plastics. The industry response, and a lot of independent experts also, to be clear, think that the world just needs to get better at recycling plastic and recycling the petrochemically made plastic. Because, and the reasoning is, you know, oil and gas petrochemical plastics are incredibly, you know, useful and effective. They last a long time. You know, there's a reason why they've proliferated the planet. It's because they've been effective. I mean, yes, you can say that oil companies have, you know, wanted to make a massive profit, but it's also the case that they're effective. I think that's sort of lost in this very polarizing debate of, you know, how evil the oil companies are. You can think they're evil, but oil and gas as a product is actually very effective from a scientific perspective. The other school of thought is that we need to get off plastics altogether because there isn't an easy substitute for oil and gas. And there's a big movement underway to do that as well. I think that's very challenging. I think we have, every one of us, most of us, rely heavily on plastics. We're talking today on Amazon's Prime Day. Many of us probably went online to buy something that's going to be shipped to us covered in plastic. The e-commerce business is one of the top reasons that plastics is expected to grow around the world. So, you know, I think there's this really intense conversation happening around the world about people coming to terms with our consumer lifestyle and whether or not we would be willing to give that up for the planet.
And we're talking about the production of this plastic, but there's also tremendous value in seeing innovation in the recycling and disposal of plastic, which is really the main problem, is that it's choking our oceans and it's filling up our landfills. Like, these things just don't biodegrade. Are there any innovations that you're aware of on a mass scale plastic production side of things that are promising in terms of their ability to biodegrade?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of innovation and attempts being done on just being better at recycling. Most of the concern about plastic waste focuses chiefly on single-use plastic. So, you know, plastic is used in so many different varieties, and a lot of experts, but including the oil and gas industry, who obviously has a financial benefit in plastics continuing to proliferate, they say that you just need to get better at recycling that, no matter where it comes from. So it's not necessarily a question of how good it can, you know, degrade. It's why can't we just get better at gathering it up? And so there's this new industry group funded by all the different layers of the plastic chain, including Exxon and Procter & Gamble. They launched it earlier this year, and their initial focus is to clean up, I think it's about 10 rivers in Asia, mostly in Asia, a couple in Africa. And I think it's something like 90% of 90% of the plastic waste in the ocean comes from these 10 rivers. So they're focused on those because that's where most of the problem is. And so if you can clean up those rivers, then maybe we don't need to feel so bad about having a plastic straw.
It's an interesting angle. But just to put a pin on the facility that we're talking about in Houston that you were reporting on, this is a $10 billion processing facility to make ethane. What does it mean for plastic prices and production? Will it lower prices ultimately? Do you think this is maybe going to increase the amount of plastic we see on the market someday?
I don't think it's going to have that direct of an impact. The demand is increasing for plastic, and the feedstock availability is increasing for plastic in the United States because of the oil and natural gas boom has made a lot of these byproducts like ethane suddenly plentifully available for a cheaper price. And so what's changing is not necessarily that global plastic prices will drop. The market is more complicated than that. But what it has made is the United States the unambiguous export leader in ethane. And in fact, there's only two countries that export ethane, the United States and Norway. And the United States has blown past Norway. And so it's good for the United States when it comes to jobs and economic growth, but it is sort of allowing the world to continue the dependence on plastics from oil and natural gas. You know, I think it's an appropriate question to say that, you know, if ethane wasn't booming in the United States, the petrochemicals would come from somewhere else. I think that's what a lot of experts say. So the focus should not be necessarily on stopping these facilities, but instead trying to find a better way to recycle the plastic that is ultimately made. However, there is an effort underway among environmentalists to protest these facilities in places like Pennsylvania and along the Gulf Coast. You're seeing a growing movement. It's not nearly as pronounced as the environmental backlash against pipelines, but nonetheless, you're seeing growing environmental opposition trying to stop these facilities from being built due to the same concerns you've heard with pipelines, you know, local air pollution and ultimately their connection to climate change.
She's the energy and climate change reporter for Axios, Amy Harder. Amy, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Grant Green and the Beatles.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.